You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. This episode was first broadcast on October 26, 2012, right here on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House here on Monocle 24, live from Studio One here in London with me, Tyler Brulé. Coming up over the next 60 minutes, with the news that Silvio Berlusconi has been sentenced for tax fraud, we'll be speaking with journalist and commentator Gianni Riotta. And jumping the Atlantic, we'll also check in and see why Brazilians are so efficient when it comes to voting.
The electorate can verify that the printed vote matches his intention, and we can count these votes at the end of the elections to see if the electronic counting was honest or not. This increases transparency significantly.
And later in the show, we'll be joined in the studio by Kitsune's co-founder, Masaya Karaki, to hear what music we should be listening to this weekend and what we should be wearing while doing it. And just a stone's throw from our New York bureau, we'll meet our neighbors at the Mile End Deli.
So we're a Jewish deli. We opened in Borum Hill, Brooklyn about 3 years ago, and our mission was really to make everything in-house from scratch. So curing, smoking, pickling, and baking, only serving the foods that we could make.
And as it's Friday, we'll also have our editor Andrew Tuck and foreign editor Steve Bloomfield here to review the week's main stories. And here they are. Steve, main story of the week.
It's the US elections. We'll be talking about what happened and what's going to happen next week.
Andrew.
Well, I think we may be dipping into some of the ceasefires and assassinations that have been going on this week.
Gentlemen, we will be seeing you in about half an hour's time. All that to come over the next hour here on Midori House, live from London on Monocle 24. And good evening from a very, very busy and buzzy Midori House. Just above our heads, we have about a good 70 people or so who are not just pulling together programs for this very radio station, but also putting our December-January issue to bed, issue number 59. Our biggest to date, which is quite something, a bit of news there, but also we have more news with Jonathan Wheatley.
An Italian court has today sentenced the former Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi to 4 years in jail, later reduced to 1 year for tax fraud in connection with the purchase of broadcasting rights by his Mediaset television company. Berlusconi has the right to appeal the ruling two more times before the sentence becomes definitive. The court also ordered damages provisionally set at 10 million euros to be paid by Berlusconi and his co-defendants to tax authorities. Appeal judges at the International Criminal Court have today turned down former Ivory Coast leader Laurent Gbagbo's request to be allowed to leave the Netherlands to await trial, saying he was a flight risk. ICC prosecutors say Gbagbo committed crimes against humanity during a four-month civil war in Ivory Coast in 2010, in which about 3,000 people died and a million people were displaced. Gbagbo's supporters, like Willy Blah, blamed the former French president Nicolas Sarkozy.
Nicolas Sarkozy have a great responsible in what happened in Ivory Coast. Why? Because Dramane Ouattara is his friend. And we cannot understand how, because of election, French army can do war with a small country like Ivory Coast.
In Syria, the first major violation of a ceasefire marking the Eid al-Adha Muslim holiday has been reported. The Syrian Observatory for Human Rights said rebel fighters were trying to storm an army base near the main road from Damascus to Aleppo, and President Bashar al-Assad's forces had fired artillery at a nearby village. Omar Shawaf of the opposition Syrian National Council says the Assad regime simply cannot be trusted.
Also, the Syrians outside Syria, like the Syrian refugees and the Syrians lived out Syria, they don't believe that Assad will be adhering with this truce. That's why nobody planned to go back to Syria and nobody trusts Assad anymore.
New York police are today hoping to interview a critically wounded nanny suspected of stabbing to death two children of a CNBC television executive in the family's luxury Manhattan apartment. The nanny, identified as Yoselin Ortega, remains sedated in a critical condition at a Manhattan hospital. Ortega, who police say cut her own throat, has not been charged because police have not been able to interview her. New York City Police Commissioner Raymond Kelly said the mother had returned home with a third child, three-year-old Nessie, after the girl's swimming lesson.
She's assuming that the nanny may have gone out with the children. She goes down to the lobby to ask the doorman if, in fact, they had gone out. He says no. She goes back up. The apartment is dark, and she goes into the bathroom. That's when she discovers the virus.
Staying in the United States, and more than half of those states have opened polling stations for early voting for the presidential election. President Barack Obama became the first sitting president to vote early yesterday, and he tried to encourage other voters to follow suit. Jamin Raskin directs the program on law and government at the American University. He said early voting forces the campaign to focus on getting voters to the polls and tends to favor the Democratic Party.
The Democratic Party is much more the party of the middle class and working class voters. So those are the people who've had the hardest time voting, squeezing it in to the couple of hours in the morning or at the end of the day.
Two states, Oregon and Washington, also vote early, but only allow postal voting. And finally, a man in central China has been sentenced to a year in jail for ringing a bell to end a national college exam entrance exam too early, forcing the students to hand in their papers nearly 5 minutes before the exam should have ended, state media have said today. The 54-year-old man admitted having rung the bell at the school in the province of Hunan 4 minutes and 48 seconds early by mistake. Poor chap. And those are the stories at the top of the hour on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much for that, Jonathan. It's just 1:06 in the morning, Saturday morning in Hong Kong, 18:06 here in London. It's 13:06 in Toronto. You're listening to Midori House here in London. We're back in a moment.
London, Toronto, Tokyo.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London.
Londres, Toronto, Tokyo.
Essa é a Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Das ist Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Londres.
Esto es Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Това е Monocle 24.
From London.
In London.
London, Cara.
De Londres.
This is Monocle 24.
And this is Midori House on Monocle 24. Earlier this afternoon, a court in Italy convicted former Italian Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi of tax fraud. The Milan court sentenced him to 4 years, but later cut it to 1 year because of an amnesty law. Along with other individuals, Berlusconi has been accused of buying U.S. film rights at inflated prices via two offshore companies under his control. He has already faced a number of trials connected to his business affairs over the years, but has either been cleared or cases have run beyond their judicial time limit. Well, we are now joined on the line by journalist Gianni Riotta, former editor of Italy's Il Sole 24. He's somewhere in transit between Rome and Milan. Hello, Gianni.
Hi, Teleo. This is the fast train you've been riding
okay.
very often.
You're on the Freccia Rossa.
Exactly. Well, everybody's talking about Silvio being sentenced to jail.
What is the buzz in the train seats around you?
People link the announcement the other day that he won't run for a sixth time in office in Italy that Berlusconi gave with the news that the judges sentenced that he has to go to jail for the tax evasion of Mediaset, this media empire. People say, now we understand why he did so. Mm-hmm. And this is like a bit of a rush because Berlusconi knows that he wasn't able to run again, and of course he knew that.
It looks like Mr. Gianni Riotta on Italy's very efficient and a train which I like very much, the Frecciarossa, which of course runs all the way from Milan down to Naples. It seems like we have lost him for the moment, maybe in a tunnel or something of a black hole. We're going to try to rejoin him, though, a little bit later in the program. You're listening to Midori House, 9 minutes after 1800 here in London. We're back in a moment.
From London, this is Monocle 24.
London ist New York ist Hong Kong ist Tokio. Sie sind Monocle 24.
Aus London, das ist Monocle 24.
Από το Λονδίνο, αυτό είναι το Monocle 24.
Вы слушаете Monocle 24.
Λονδόστα καζίν, τέμα ον Monocle 24.
London μπορ, έζε Monocle 24.
Λονδόντα, μπορέσε Monocle 24.
London ist, σύνο Monocle 24.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
お聞きになっているのはモノクル24。
アフトエンドモノクル24。
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Du lyssnar på Monocle 24.
Kuuntelet Monocle 24.
Viestes Monocle 24.
Esto es Monocle 24.
Detta är Monocle 24.
En Monocle 24, how about ya?
You're listening to Midori House. Well, we've been trying and trying to reach Mr. Gianni Riotta, who, of course, we were chatting to just moments ago about the sentencing of Silvio Berlusconi, but no news at the moment. We'll try him a little bit later in the program, and we will now head to the other side of the Atlantic. Election season is continuing to rage on in the Americas. In Brazil, some municipalities will have to go to the polls again this Sunday to vote in the runoff elections. And what's more interesting is how Brazilians will be voting with 100% electronic voting machines. Brazil is one of the world leaders when it comes to electronic voting, but these systems haven't gone without controversy. Our correspondent, Sheena Rossiter, has more.
It's election day in Brazil's biggest city, Sao Paulo, and crowds of Brazilians huddle here to cast their mandatory votes for the city's mayor and for their choice of city councillors. Machines beep away, confirming that votes have been cast and are locked in. It's a system that Brazilians are now used to, having had 100% electronic voting terminals for nearly 20 years. It's one of the few countries to collect votes entirely in this way, as Sidney Coutts, president of Unidade Electoral Research, explains.
O Brasil é pioneiro nessa forma de...
Brazil is a pioneer with this way of collecting votes. It's extremely fast. In a city like Sao Paulo with 9 million voters, within 2.5 hours, the election is pretty much already determined. An emerging market can be ahead of other countries in terms of electronic voting systems. I think that we're now past the stage of criticism. Now the population believes a lot more in the electronic voting machines than they did 15 years ago.
But as Sidney explains, it's a model that may not work everywhere.
Electronic voting machines shouldn't be encouraged to be used in non-democratic countries or where there's suspicion of having dictators, because it's really easy to commit fraud. It's easy for you to process all of this data, and it's also really easy to manipulate this data. You need to have a good third party supervising the voting process, but it's still a much more trustworthy system than voting on paper.
Olá! Você já sabe que as eleições representam ponto alto da democracia.
But not everyone is convinced that excluding paper from ballot boxes is completely transparent. Back in March, Brazil's electoral authority, the TSE, ran a challenge to evaluate the security of the voting machines. This was the first time that third parties outside the electoral authority were allowed to access them. Diego Aranha and his team won the challenge, and he says transparency needs to be increased significantly.
No software is absolutely secure, especially when it scales to 60 million source code lines, as this is the size of the voting software in our voting machine. We should have some materialized version of the vote, so we can do recounts. The elector can verify that the printed vote matches his intention, and we can count these votes at the end of the elections to see if the electronic counting was honest or not. This increases transparency significantly.
And others agree with Diego Aranha, like Aclimar Brunazano Filho, a computer engineer who specializes in electoral data. He's been hired by the TSE several times to advise on the security of these machines. And he admits that Brazil is actually behind the rest of the world in terms of voting technology, despite the government's claims the system is state-of-the-art.
In the rest of the world, where they use electronic voting systems, there exists a printed vote, or a scanned vote, that allows voters to confirm their choice. And the cost isn't that high. It's similar to the cost that we have here for voting machines now in Brazil. The Brazilian Electoral Authority creates a lot of publicity around these machines, distorted publicity, that these machines are accepted in the rest of the world. But we've analyzed this to see what's happening, and this information is false. Brazilian electronic voting machines were rejected in all Latin American countries where they got to test them. The Brazilian model was prohibited in Holland, it was declared unconstitutional in Germany, and it was excluded for its technology in North America.
E está fora, excluído da norma técnica norte-americana.
Brazil did briefly introduce a paper confirmation to go alongside the electronic vote in 2002, but technical problems caused the government to backtrack. And because fraud was even more rampant when Brazilians only voted through paper ballots, electronic voting in Brazil still is viewed as quite high-tech. This year, the TSE had a budget of 129 million reais. That's about 36 million US dollars to operate the electronic voting terminals. There were delays to get the machines checked securely because of bidding delays in the government-run auctions for the project. Carlos Haddad is the commercial director for Smartmatic Brazil, one of the three companies responsible for the hard and software of these machines. He thinks the delay didn't impact their transparency.
I think today the system here is very transparent. There is a law which has been voted in 2010, I think, that approved the printing of the vote. So whatever you go there, you vote and you print, and you can take a copy of your vote with you. The law is scheduled to be effective in 2014, and that will, I think, it will give the 100% transparency on the way the election is done.
He says that in a young democracy like Brazil, these electronic voting machines allow the country to keep moving forward.
These systems enable democracy to happen in a way that in some countries of the third world will take much longer to happen because of the way you can fight people that are trying to get elected without the votes or buying the votes. More and more the systems here are becoming so complex that to fool around elections in Brazil is very complicated today.
Boa noite. Eleições 2012.
But others, like Diego Aranha, feel that Brazil's electronic voting process is getting ahead of itself.
We shouldn't put absolute trust on the system. We should still be vigilant and pay attention to the behavior in the vote, in the polling places and etc. We are not at a point that we can have purely electronic elections.
The first round of municipal elections have just passed in Brazil, with questionable results in some municipalities. One city councillor in a Sao Paulo suburb reportedly received 100% of the valid electronic votes, with the rest being registered as void or blank. Aside from the question of who the opposition there actually voted for, there's still debate raging on whether the technology being used in Brazil's elections is worth voting for. For Monocle, in Sao Paulo, I'm Sheena Rossiter.
And I'm now joined in the studio by our resident Brazilian. We need to get another Brazilian, in, at least on the editorial floor. Of course, we have someone on one of the other floors of the building to keep you company, Fernando Augusto Pacheco.
Oh, I like to be by myself.
I know. I think you like your special status. And the first thing I was going to ask you, can you reflect on the story? Because the way you're dressed this afternoon, are you old enough to vote? That's what I need to know.
Oh, come on. Don't you like my floral shirt?
With the rather arctic temperatures, it's warming things up for sure. Have you voted? Have you tried out the system?
Actually, unfortunately not, because I can't vote as a Brazilian abroad to the local elections. I can only vote for the presidential ones, but I would love to.
Right. So you've never tried, you haven't sampled this technology yet.
Oh, no, I did. I did. Actually, I voted in 2002 when I was living Brazil.
And that's what I was getting at.
Oh,
okay.
Yes.
So you have tried it.
I did. And it's very efficient. Mm. There are almost no queues. You just go there, type the number, and it's very easy.
Well, I mean, it is curious, though, Heather, saying that Brazil is behind, but Brazil is behind electronically because, of course, if we look at the United States, it is amazing that one of the most technologically advanced countries in the world, still operates in a very analog way. No,
yeah, it's very weird because in Brazil we know the results. I mean, the same day, like I don't know, the ballots are closed at 6, and at 8 you have already
the results.
Yeah,
exactly. And now, of course, as we're saying, so this is election weekend. One of the big, votes to watch is, of course, in the biggest city, which is in Sao Paulo. We have a runoff happening. What are the Brazilian papers saying as to where things are going to end up?
Well, it seems to me that the Workers' Party candidate this time is Fernando Haddad, which is a fresh name. It's his first time running for mayor. I believe he's going to win. At the time, he has 49% in the polls, and the center-right candidate has 35%. And I don't think José Serra has a good chance to win, because I think paulistanos are a bit kind of tired of him because he already ran for president. He was mayor of São Paulo. He was governor of the state.
Governor of the state, yeah.
So I think they want something new and fresh. And that's where the Workers' Party was smart. Mm. Because they didn't put Marta Suplicy, which used to be mayor of São Paulo as well. They decided to go for a new name. And most of all, his name is not involved in the men's salon scandal,
right,
which is happening at the moment. And it didn't affect the Workers' Party that much, I have to say.
Right. And it seems then if Haddad gets in, judging by the name, sounds like Lebanese origins to me. So the Lebanese dynasties will continue to rule Sao Paulo as well.
They will. We like our Lebanese.
Of course you do. And you like your Beirutis as well at lunchtime.
Oh, don't even tell me, Tyler.
I know. It is sort of dinner time here. Fernando, we're going to have to leave it there. Have a very good weekend. You're listening to Midori House. Off for a short break. We're heading to Belgium after this.
Thanks.
Wonderful.
If I have the privilege of being your president for another 4 years, I promise you I will always listen to your voices. I will work every single day to make sure that America continues to be the greatest nation on earth.
I'd like to be the next president of the United States to support and help this great nation and to make sure that we all together maintain America as the hope of the earth.
As the countdown to the U.S. elections continues, Monocle 24 is heading to America for a series of election specials. Every day until Election Day itself, Midori House will be coming to you live from New York City. I'll be joined by a host of political guests for an hour of news, debate and analysis on the world's most exciting elections. So join us every day on Midori House for Monocle 24's election specials. I'm Steve Bloomfield and I approve this message.
Be our guest and come spend the weekend with Monocle 24. We kick off on Saturday with the Weekend Edition, a smart, relaxing selection of music, news headlines and great conversation.
There's real excitement there, you know, and it's sort of like, wow, I don't really understand what they're doing, but I love the sound of it.
Then join us for our brand new show, The Stack, celebrating the world of print media, from chunky Korean glossies to fine-tuned Brazilian newspapers. Hosted by Tyler Brulé, each week we pull in guest reviewers to crack open spines and thumb through inky pages to reveal why there's more to journalism than going digital.
The publication you have in your hand is all about women across the Middle East. The one in your hand is about skiing in Morocco. They have one about the Saudi pavilion in the Osaka Expo. So it was very progressive.
Later, this Saturday review casts a critical eye over the week's literature, music, TV, cinema and the arts and delivers some fun, fast-paced conversation too.
It's a bit of a riot, actually. They just boiled the crayfish in water.
That sounds like a riot so far.
On Sunday, stay over for the Monocle Weekly, our longest-running radio show that brings our editors face-to-face with everyone from academics to war correspondents, historians to social commentators, and serves up some fine music too.
I sort of came to Brazilian music quite late. Yeah, it's something that I'm still discovering.
And don't miss The Curator, our one-hour survey of the week's highlights on Monocle 24. That's the new weekend lineup on Monocle 24.
And welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. It's 1923 over on the continent, 1823 here in London. Now, a strange crime and media story from Brussels. This morning, Belgian police started an appeal for help in their investigation of the murder of a British oil company executive who was gunned down nearly 2 weeks ago. Nicholas Mockford was shot as he left a restaurant in Brussels with his wife, who was also injured in the attack by two men carrying crash helmets. The case had received no coverage in the UK until today, and there was some confusion as to whether an apparent media blackout in Belgium was the result of a special police request or usual practice when investigating such a serious crime. There's plenty of speculation that Mockford, who had worked for ExxonMobil since the 1970s, was the target of a professional hit or perhaps the hapless victim of a bungled street robbery. So, what do we know about the case, and how distracted should we be by the apparent vagaries of the media coverage? Well, we're joined on the line now by Kirst Verselers, who's the crime reporter at Het Laatste Nieuws, who also broke the story. Hello, Kirst.
Hi, good evening.
Hi. When did the story break? Because I caught this very early this morning in the UK. It then started to pop up elsewhere. When did you break the story in your paper?
Well, it was on Monday morning, 15 of October, we've wrote about it. It happened the evening before at 100 hours on Sunday evening. We've already heard about carjacking that or about crime that has gone wrong in Brussels. A carjacking, probably. That was the first thing they said, and we wrote about it. It was published Monday morning already.
So you got it in the next day's edition. Then what happened? In, of course, an era when things travel incredibly fast. This is obviously quite high profile, given we're talking about an American company, a British expatriate living in Belgium. How did it unfold after that?
Well, it took me quite a while to discover who the victim was. I think we had identified him by Monday afternoon, and at that moment, we realized it was British manager of ExxonMobil, and it was very important person for this company. And we published a big story about what happened. At that moment, police said they did not have any answers to a motive of the people who've killed Mr. Mockford, and they said maybe it's a theft gone wrong, a carjacking gone wrong, but they didn't know at that moment. And frankly, at this moment, we're 2 weeks later, apparently they don't have any clue.
Now, the way this story unfolded here earlier today was that of a news blackout. And of course, that raises all kinds of questions in a liberal democracy like Belgium. But was that really the case, or you could have continued carrying on with the story if you wanted to?
Yes, of course. Of course, there was there was absolutely no news blackout. What happened that Belgian justice isn't too keen on giving details, so in ongoing investigations. So we have to do it all by ourselves. You know, they don't provide us names or of victims or whatsoever. So it's not a blackout. It's a decision of the judge that you can call it a blackout, but it's a decision of the judge that decides. I don't need media at this moment to help me look for or to publish stories that can maybe get in the way of the investigation. Mm.
So was it your own hard work as a crime correspondent that actually uncovered the name and everything else? Even these details were not being released by the judicial system?
It's always the case in Belgium, yes. It's how it works. In Belgium we have press officers, but I've been a journalist for like 15 years, and they always say less and less in Belgium. So it's how it works.
Well, it's good to hear that there's still a need for your craft. That's good news for you as a journalist.
well, it's not that. How do you say? At this moment, apparently they do need the press, because there is yesterday evening or this morning, I can't remember exactly, they asked to publish that they are looking for a car in this particular case. So at some points they do need us, and at other points they don't. And at the beginning of an investigation, mostly they don't. So.
Chris, what have you also found out? Obviously, if the judges and the police are being tight-lipped about this, anything else in this case? Does it look like indeed a carjacking gone wrong, or is this a score being settled, or something slightly darker?
Well, at this moment, officially, police and justice say everything is possible. We investigate about everything, so. That means, yes, there was this from the beginning, the story about the carjacking, but the people who killed Mr. Mockford left the car at the scene. So very doubtful. Then there is this story about the handbag of the of Mrs. Mockford, who was with him at the time of the crime. Apparently, there was the people shouted that they wanted the bag. So there is a possibility that it was about bag lifting that also has gone wrong. In both cases, everybody and certainly police is asking questions about the violence that is used. You do not kill somebody over a car or a handbag that easily. From the beginning, the police has also taken into account that maybe there is something more. And in that, for that, they are also have been investigating the personal life of the victim, his work. At this moment, ExxonMobil says there are absolutely no indications that the crime has got anything to do with the company or with the work that Mr. Mockford did. Nobody actually knows. There are a few eyewitnesses that say about that talk about two people wearing motor helmets shooting and running away, and that's about it. And for the rest, it's been a mystery for 2 weeks.
Just before we go, I imagine this type of crime is unprecedented. We don't hear a lot about people being gunned down in the streets of Western Europe very often, and certainly not in Brussels. But also, what is your journalist's gut instinct to tell you about this, police aside?
I'm sorry, I've not understood the question.
Sorry,
I
was just saying, what does your journalistic instinct tell you, aside from what the police are not really saying? I think we've lost the line. That was Kurs Versler's crime correspondent for Het Laatste Nieuws in Belgium. We are now going over to Mr. Jonathan Wheatley with the bottom of the hour headlines.
Thank you very much. An Italian court has today sentenced former Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi to 4 years in jail, later reduced to 1 year, for tax fraud in connection with the purchase of broadcasting rights by his Mediaset television company. Berlusconi has the right to appeal the ruling two more times before the sentence becomes definitive. Appeal judges at the International Criminal Court have today turned down former Ivory Coast leader Laurent Gbagbo's request to be allowed to leave the Netherlands to await trial, saying he was a flight risk. ICC prosecutors say Gbagbo committed crimes against humanity during a four-month civil war in Ivory Coast in 2010, in which about 3,000 people died and a million were displaced. In Syria, major violations of a ceasefire marking the Eid al-Adha Muslim holiday have been reported from both sides. New York police are today hoping to interview a critically wounded nanny suspected of stabbing to death two children of a CNBC television executive in the family's luxury Manhattan apartment. The nanny, identified as Yoselin Ortega, remains sedated in a critical condition at a Manhattan hospital. And staying in the United States, more than half of those states have now opened polling stations for early voting for the presidential election. Two other states, Oregon and Washington, also vote early but only allow postal voting. And I'll have more news for you at the top of the hour.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
Where you London? This is Monocle 24.
Ut London, my Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London, desde Londres.
Holanda.
London から.
London으로부터.
From London.
This is Monocle 24.
And welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. It is 2:34 in Tokyo, 19:34 in Paris, 1834 here in London. I'm happy to say that I am joined by a very good friend of the family here, Messiah Koraki, who is the man, at least one half of the duo behind Maison Kitsune. Of course, very famous for all things musically related on the dance floor, but certainly in terms of our relationship, a collaborator on things fashioned. I think many people listening will, of course, know your garments. They frequently appear on the pages of our magazine. Welcome. How are you?
Konbanwa. Thank you for the introduction. Thank you very much. Good to see you.
Not at all. Very good to see you. Now, two things. I promised our listeners at the top of the program you're going to play something for us, but we'll do that when we say goodbye. Yeah. But I wanted to ask you, we have, of course, the spring collections are going to be hitting stores. Yep. Very good stores will be getting them probably, you know, if not before Christmas, just after Christmas. Mm-hmm. But you're also through your design season already. You've already been selling quite soon for next season.
Yes.
Just looking at the market, there's been so much discussion right now over the over the week. When we look at the luxury goods business, a lot of people raising question marks. A brand like Mulberry has had bad results. Coach not doing very well, having to offer up coupons, etc. So it seems that all of this, you know, what's been sort of the mass end of luxury, etc., is having a bit of a hard time. And I'm wondering, do you think that's the way that the market is actually going, Messiah? That those who are really focused at the top end and can really sort of stand behind what their brand is doing are probably going to weather the storm okay. And if you're a Uniqlo, then you're also going to be all right.
Yeah, sure. No, I think the I think it's true. I mean, we read a lot of things. I mean, a lot of investment and, you know, and very slow movement of the cash in, cash out. But I think in general, consumer's level getting simply higher and higher, you know, not because of the, you know, all the authentic luxury brands since a while, or fast retailing. There's a, such a, you know, the gap between the fast, very, very fast fashion, which is a really big group, and then authentic old school houses. And there's a distance between, which is, you know, people are kind of stocked, I think, the consumer is stocked. So when they see a lot of investment, they just feel maybe invaded too much, maybe. Through the media, by the media, or through maybe the too much billboard or something like that. And simply, I think the consumers want enjoy, they want something they really want, not because it's trendy or it's because they have to. There is always, you know, the must of the year, the must of the, you know, you have to buy some product. No, I think the consumers are more like, oh, it's that looks good on me? Yes, maybe. How is the price? Good price, okay. I think they're becoming more and more difficult simply, and then more, let's say, simple way to do the shopping, actually. Going back to the roots, maybe.
What works for you when you speak to, of course, you have your own retail as well, but then also when you, of course, speak to those people that you wholesale to as well. What drives transaction? Is it still getting good editorial? Is it having a skilled salesperson who knows how to manage their email database? And then certainly in the case with your own stores, you know, when people come in, you know, and they want that blazer, that coat, how have they normally found out about it?
Well, for my case, and which is, you know, I mean, right now it's Paris and New York for my on flagship. And
I finally went to your store in New York the other day, by the way.
Thank you.
Very nice.
Thank you. Thank you. And well, we are not that much in a magazine yet, like other, you know, big brands or other groups. So for my case, usually people come in because the store looks good, and then they saw the window, it looks nice, and then they're asking what is the product. And what is important is especially the fitting, how the people feel, not just comfortable, but has to fit, and the price and product has to be balanced. I think that is one of the important things, which is, you know, you can't always control or you can't always focus on it because of the, you know, the brand identity or, you know, communication-wise, you have certain budget you have to spend, et cetera, et cetera. But I think today consumers are not that much influenced by, you know, what they see every day in the street through the media, you know, the commercials or advertising, I think.
At the start of the program, we were talking about the departure, well, not departure, well, he's already departed from the stage, but the conviction of Silvio Berlusconi and, you know, the ongoing saga of Italy. When I speak to a lot of fashion brands, I mean, everyone, I mean, Italy has been such a strong market, not just for Italian brands, but so many companies. You speak to champagne producers, you speak to watch brands. I mean, Italy has been an incredibly important luxury goods market. First, how is Italy faring for you? And second of all, what markets are growing? Where are you seeing uptake when you look at various economies and your brand?
I think first of all, I mean, 70% of the fabrics my collections are all from Italy. And half of the production is in Italy too. So of course I'm actually supporting a lot already the manufacturing, and then I'm very close to them in terms of the product and where the markets go, et cetera, et cetera. But I think Italians has this, you know, very classic traditional consumers, and then they have this, you know, very fast and let's say sometimes can looks like a little bit like advertising because they have like three brand on them and it looks like a commercial a little bit, but that's the way, that's the how the, you know, the culture wise, that's, you know. But I think when I'm offering my collection, which is kind of timeless but modern shape, etc., it's hard for me to tell where I would like to go, because all the Italians can wear my collection basically, because I have a certain style which is kind of traditional, but in the meantime quite fresh and very colorful, and then certain quality. So everything can be appreciated by Italians in general. So I would like to go from the north to the south, but right now, what the Italians go through, of course, it's very, very niche. Actually, I'm talking to certain stores has already, maybe certain category of the consumer already, which is sensitive for the quality, for the fitting, for the new product, or for timeless or classics, but something still has to be a little bit trendy as well for them, you know, to change, because they're really, really, really sensitive, you know, for the clothes, because they have the great culture of the fashion and product.
So if Italy is looking a little bit flat, what markets are growing for you right now? Where are you, you know, whether we're talking about whole countries or certain cities that, you know, we should be keeping an eye out for?
Asia. Well, of course, Japan is already my main market already, but Hong Kong is good, Singapore is good, Bangkok in a few years probably, but Seoul is already a few years already going there. But they're getting more and more into, not just they heard about it, Maison Kitsune, but simply something new come from Europe, you know, something with quality, something with some manufacturing behind the product. I think that's Asian people are getting more and more sensitive.
And what about China?
China, it's for me, it's still very huge, blind.
Right.
Yeah, I'm not ready yet, and probably.
Is the Chinese consumer ready yet?
Probably they do shopping somewhere, somehow, outside of China, probably.
Because we keep on hearing that the market is now becoming very sophisticated. I'm not quite sure how that all changed in 6 months. But anyway, that's another discussion.
Yeah.
But everyone says, oh, well, now the consumer, they don't, you know, as we say, they stop, you know, oh, well, they don't want Coach and they don't want these bags now because they're so sophisticated. And now they're going for really, really super niche brands, et cetera. I'm not convinced.
Me neither. I don't feel in that way. I don't think that way. No, I think they are looking for definitely something new, which is they don't see every day simply. But doesn't mean it's something good, or doesn't mean something quality, or doesn't mean something stylish, or I don't know. I think it's simply the way to kind of excuse to not buy always the same brand.
You've selected a song for us. Set it up tell us a little bit about it before we go and play it.
Yeah, this is the this is a really, really good band, Citizens, which is we're producing this band, and then
Citizens are French, or where are they from?
They're from UK. They're French. They're English. And then produced by Alex Capranot, which is a singer. I mean, main vocal of the Franz Ferdinand, great band. And then the True Romance. It's one of the biggest hits of this fall winter, probably.
Excellent. Messiah.
Thank you very much.
From Kitsune. Thanks for that. This is True Romance. And that was Citizens with True Romance here on Midori House, Monocle 24, 1848 here in London. And I'm joined by my colleagues, Andrew Tuck. He's the editor of this magazine. And Steve Bloomfield, he is the foreign editor of this magazine. Sometimes I think foreign editor sounds more glamorous than editor. What do you think, Andrew?
Yeah, and I'm always worried that Sophie Grove's called senior editor. It sounds like she's in charge of us all. Yeah.
Exactly.
She somehow got the best title there.
She does. Now, if we rewind, look back over the last 7 days, Andrew, I'll start with you. The week that was.
Let's do a kind of serious one. And I know you're going to be speaking to Gianni Riotta in a little while, but it's a funny week where there's quite a few things that have made the headlines that you realise are never going to happen. So I think, first of all, the ceasefire in Syria, you just know that it's not going to hold. And it's been, you know, great that they've been trying to put something together for Eid, but that isn't going to happen. And then, you know, of course, it's interesting seeing Berlusconi charged today, found guilty today, and this supposed jail sentence. But let's hear what Gianni says.
Yes,
but again,
I think we have Mr. Gianni Riotta on the Freccia Rossa still. Gianni, are you there?
I just got to Milan. Yes, I'm here.
Okay, perfect. So you're on terra firma. This is very good news. We also have Steve and Andrew here as well. When I left you last time, you were giving me the chatter in the train carriage. A very busy night, obviously, for Italian television and journalists. This is dominating the news, but is it much surprise, I guess twofold, that it was first going to be 4 years and then it's already been dropped to 1 year?
Yes, the point is not if he'll go to jail. He won't go to jail at all. The point is that will he run again to be Prime Minister of Italy? No, he will not. He announced that he will not run again 2 days ago, and today the judges gave him the last nail in his coffin. He won't run. That's what is very important, because the center-right now is leaderless in Italy. So anything can happen before the political election for prime minister in the spring 2013.
Gianni, this is Steve here in the studio with Tyler. Are we seeing a sort of a handing over of the baton from the old guard to the new when you look at the ages of some of the candidates? Matteo Renzi on the left is in his late 30s. The candidates likely to be competing for the leadership of the center-right are in their 40s. Are we seeing a new broom?
I wrote a column for the Daily La Stampa that will run tomorrow saying this is the beginning of a new season. Whether the center-left will be run by Bersani or Renzi, whether the center-right will be led by Alfano, that is Berlusconi right-hand man, or another candidate that we don't know yet, and they may decide to run in the primaries in the next few weeks, a lot of new faces will be showing before the election next year.
Will we ever see Berlusconi even going back to court, or does this also just fade away like everything else has so far?
I think that Berlusconi will run for his seat in the House for many different reasons. First of all, he needs immunity. He doesn't trust the Italian justice system to give him a fair hearing. So I think he will give himself the shield of immunity for sure. So he will run. But little by little, he will withdraw from political action. I don't think that actually Berlusconi, I spoke to some of his of people in his inner circle just 2 days ago in Rome. And he doesn't seem to be in the command area anymore. I think he simply listens to their advices and then ponders what to do. But I don't think he's an hands-on leader at all.
Gianni Riotta Stazione Centrale in Milano. Thanks for that. We will look forward to seeing your piece in La Stampa tomorrow.
It's always terrific to talk to you guys.
Have a good weekend. Very interesting, the picture he painted at the end of sounded like someone really sort of bumbling around in their corner office a little bit. And we know he's not quite like that, but A bit of a damning portrait there.
But it is so intriguing how that it's been. The Italians have tolerated this for so long. You know, we've had an example here in the UK of a minister being forced out of government because he was a little bit rude to a policeman. And here, and here you have a prime minister who, you know, is he's been up on charges to do with child sex with a juvenile, prostitution, throwing crazy parties, you know, fiddling his taxes. And somehow the Italian people are kind of very, even now, oddly forgiving of it. He still has a constituency, and that's extraordinary.
And yet the thing that's perhaps most damaging for him isn't the sentence itself. It's the fact that his lawyers are arguing he can't go to prison because he's too old.
I know, that dreadful. And also, how would one smuggle in hair dye and all kinds of things? You'd have to sort of, you know, wonder what would happen. Or would they just allow him to tether his yacht to the prison and it all would be fine in Italy?
Yes, I think he would find prison life a little bit difficult. But as Gianni says, he's not going to have to deal with that.
Steve, just before we go, because we have to head over to New York to meet our neighbours over there, but if you look back over the week, so Italy aside, of course, events in Syria, what stands out for you?
Horses and bayonets. This was the two words that Barack Obama used against Mitt Romney when Romney attacked him during the foreign policy debate, saying, our Navy is smaller than it was in 1917. And he pointed out that obviously, you know, things change and there are less horses and bayonets in the US armed forces right now. And it was just that sign that he was taking it seriously, that he could hit back properly. It was another win for him in the debates. We're off to New York next week for a series of shows on Midori House. We'll see whether he can wrap it up.
And also very, very nice promo that you've created for yourself. And you've also given me a fantastic segue about going to New York, because it's time to meet the people at Mile End, who have reinvented the traditional New York deli with a focus on top service and a menu that offers something for just about everyone. Here's Ray Berminoff, who founded Mile End along with her husband Noah, with an original location in Brooklyn's Borum Hill and more recent location on Bond Street, and it's where all of our bureau goes and tucks in.
I'm Ray Burnimoff, co-owner of Mile End Delicatessen, and we're sitting here on Bond Street in NoHo at our sandwich shop, which opened in May of this year. So we're a Jewish deli. We opened in Borum Hill, Brooklyn about 3 years ago, and our mission was really to make everything in-house from scratch. So curing, smoking, pickling, and baking, only serving the foods that we could make. And that actually really started with only a few items on our menu, the smoked meat being the specialty. So that's a cured and smoked beef brisket, which takes about 2 weeks from start to finish. And that's definitely, you know, our most popular item and the thing that we're known for. But the sandwich shop is an offshoot of the original delicatessen, and it really focuses on the beauty of ingredients between bread. So beyond our smoked meat sandwich, we offer options like a smoked mackerel sandwich, or we have a new vegetarian option, which isn't really at the core or the heart of the delicatessen, but is something that speaks to the neighborhood that we're in here in NoHo. Beyond the smoked meat, which is super simple, it's just the brisket on house-baked rye with mustard, we have a dozen other sandwiches, and it's everything from a house-made hot dog, so an all-beef dog that's stuffed in-house and served on a bun that we make with poppy seeds and a fresh relish. The Walensky is one of my favorites. That's actually named after the 90-something-year-old proprietress of Walensky's Light Lunch, which is located in the Mile End in Montreal. It's a super old-school little, like, lunch counter that serves only one thing, a pressed salami sandwich. And this sandwich that we serve here is an interpretation of that. So we make all-beef salami, we fry that up, and then press it on an onion roll. Again, you know, very few ingredients, not that much complexity in terms of the number of things that go into the sandwich, but, you know, it packs a lot of flavor, and we take care in preparing each and every ingredient in-house. We also have poutine, which is like the late-night kind of Quebecois specialty. It's otherwise known as a beer sponge because it's French fries topped with cheese curds and smothered in gravy. We actually offer an option with our smoked meat on top, so you can sort of like take it to the next level. That's definitely not necessarily like a deli classic, but it speaks to the inspiration that we take from Montreal, and it's like a super satisfying late night snack. And in the morning, you know, we have actually just started serving our hand-rolled house-baked bagels. So for many years, we were actually importing them from Montreal because they were the bagels that my husband Noah grew up on, and most people couldn't understand how, you know, we're in New York City and we couldn't find a bagel that we wanted to serve that was locally made, and we just felt like New York and Montreal bagels are sort of like apples and oranges. They're two different breeds, and I think that there's room for both in anyone's heart, and mine certainly. And so we were actually shipping the St. Viateur bagels overnight. Again, that's a bagel shop located in Mile End in Montreal, and you know, serving them in our restaurants. And for months and months, we worked on our own recipes and how we could prepare them ourselves. And finally are able to serve those for breakfast with some house-cured lox, a schmear of cream cheese, tomato, caper, onion, the classic.
Ah, the good old debate, New York bagels versus Montreal bagels. That was Ray Berminoff, founder of the Mile End Deli in New York. That's all the time we have for today. And our producer for this program was Dawn Trump. Our researcher is Fernando Augusto Pacheco. You heard from him earlier as well. And our studio manager is Toby Hammond. Up next, after the news, it's this week's edition of The Menu with our Marcus Hippie. And in 3 hours' time after that, at 2200 London, I'm Andrew Muller. And Marcus Hippie is back again with The Monocle Daily. But for now, from all of us here in London, it is a very good evening. I am back tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock with the weekend edition of The Stack. Goodbye.